The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words. And those taking part are Anne Scott James, Frank Muir, Gillis Powell, and Dennis Norton. Round one tries to test their respective vocabularies. 2 marks if they get the meaning of these words roughly right. Anne, we begin with you, Anne Scott James. What is a pithecanthrope?
Well, it's either something in nature, I would think.
It's anthropology.
Yes, that's it.
Some sort of a man.
Nearly.
Is it a monkey?
Yes, half there.
That's right. It's halfway to Darwin. That's what.
That's it.
Yes, it's a half-developed ape or something.
Well, a half-developed ape wouldn't be taking very far.
Well, it's midway between an ape and a man.
That's exactly what I wanted. All right, I think you do get your 2 marks here. The pithecanthrope is the ape-man, this hypothetical link, as they once thought, between ape and man. The phrase was coined by Haeckel in 1876, and then they found a thing they called Pithecanthropus erectus, which is the ape-man who walked for the first time on his hind legs. 2 marks. Frank Muir, what is a tetrawort? T-E-T-T-E-R-W-O-R-T. Tetrawort.
Tetrawort. Well, it's a bird, isn't it?
No. It stays in one place.
So that rumour that Shelley originally wrote his poem. It isn't so. Heavenly blithe spirit, bird thou tetrawort. Well, then it's a plant.
Yes, it's a plant.
A tetrawort plant.
Yes.
It's a cross between a lord and lady and an old man's beard. Found by canal banks and disused dustbins.
It's the larger celandine, and it was called that because it was supposed to cure skin diseases, and the generic term once upon a time for skin disease was tetra. Now, Dennis Powell, what is a proa? P-R-O-A. Proa.
Something Malaysian.
Yes, it is.
It's Malaysian. It's Malaysian. It's a boat.
Well done. How does it sort of go?
Forwards.
Absolutely necessary.
It doesn't go, you have to push it.
Well, it could go backwards
with if you were rowing the wrong way or had the sail up the wrong
That's
way.
That's it, yeah, that'll do.
Your sail.
No, don't say any more, no.
That'll do, 2 marks. It's a type of Malay boat, usually, but not always a sailing boat. 2 marks. Dennis Norton, what is a belcher? B-E-L-C-H-E-R.
It's obviously not any kind of wind instrument. wasn't it that thing that Victorian navvies wore?
Yes.
Well, this is a thing that was knotted. They used to have a little handkerchief knotted round their necks. A fashion which has come back in France.
Do you remember why it was called that, Dennis? You're quite
well,
right.
It was either after Jem Belcher, yes. I believe there was a painter called Sir George Belcher.
Stick to your first thought, which is absolutely accurate. 2 marks it is. This is a thing and not a chap. It's a party-coloured neckerchief, usually blue ground with white spots, and it's named after Jem Belcher, who was a very, very famous boxer in the early 19th century. Now, before we begin round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down. And then I hope that the 2 women members of the teams will study those quotations, because at the end of the program, I shall ask them where the quotations come from. Anne Scott James and Dennis Norton, your quotation is, "What are the wild waves saying?" And Gillis and Frank Muir, yours is your journey really necessary? And then at the end of the program, I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their ideas of how these are going to be said or written. Next round is a round of odds and ends, and again 2 marks for correct answers. Anne Scott James, the expression next of kin is a fairly everyday one, but who are your next of kin in order of precedence?
Oh, that's a nasty one. Mm. I should have thought husband and wife came first.
They do.
Now, parents or children? Then children, your father and mother, I would think, in that order.
No, Dennis, you're right.
Children next, isn't it?
Children, yeah.
Yep, that's right. Equally if they're both alive, that's right. So they're both right. After that?
Well, then your parents. Oh.
Then?
then Auntie Liz, then cousin Winnie.
then your grandchildren, say, over the age of five.
I was up and down those stairs. If I was up and down those stairs once, I was up and down those stairs a dozen times. Who was it looked after him when he was bad?
All right, I think you're home. 2 marks. For the record, husband or wife first, children, father or mother, if all that lot are alive, they all come second. Brothers and sisters, half-brothers and sisters, grandparents, uncles and aunts, half-uncles and aunts, and when you've finally exhausted all the lot and you don't know where your money's going, the crown. Too much. Thank you. Who are the provos and where do they operate?
Aren't they the young
yes.
people of Dutch land?
Yes.
The Dutch protesters, the young people
mm-hmm. remember
making a point against their government.
Do you remember anything they did or didn't do?
Is that provocateurs, provos?
Nearly, yes. Yeah. Provos were a society of youngsters in Amsterdam who called themselves the provotariat rather than the proletariat. They hated life as it is now in almost every way. They started mainly with practical jokes and all sorts of nonsense games all around the city. They had a number of bicycles which they painted white and they left round.
That's like gave people.
That's right, and yeah. gave people who
pick
wanted
them up. Yeah.
Pick them up anywhere yeah. they went.
It's a marvellous idea.
Very good idea indeed. Yes.
Yeah.
But after that they went a bit sick, I think, and did a lot of riots and attacks on the public and so on. They don't seem to have any particular programme. Now, Dillis Bauer, what was the Pinkham?
The Pinkham was a paper or magazine.
That,
kind of sporting.
Yes, do you remember what it was called? You've got it nearly.
Sporting Life.
Not quite.
Sporting Times.
Yes, that's right. Sporting Times. Yes. What was it like?
What was it like? Well, it was full of stuff about sporting life and a bit rude.
Yes.
And it's looper.
Elder, yeah. 2 marks. Yeah. The Sporting Times, it disappeared quite a long time ago, was printed on pink paper, and it's the Edwardian readers, and those later like myself, who were taught to consider it as fast and naughty and rather shocking. Now, Dennis Norden. We've heard of jumbo-sized cigarettes and jumbo jets and things of that sort. Who was Jumbo, anyway?
Well, it's a name that they always call an elephant.
Yes, but which elephant?
Well, I would say there was quite a famous show, musical, called Jumbo, which Rodgers and Hart wrote, with Jimmy Durante made his entrance and on a elephant called Jumbo, and which was a sort of great part of the plot, and there was a marvellous song
mm-hmm.
from it. Two marvellous songs.
This is an actual historical elephant that I was trying to get at.
Well, I've showed off a bit anyway. So I don't know now.
Mm. All right, 1.5. Jumbo was about the biggest African elephant that anybody's ever come across, and was for years in the London Zoo, and masses and masses of children went for rides on that elephant, but was sold by the zoo to Barnum and Bailey, and went round in Barnum and Bailey's show and circus as one of their greatest attractions, and then, very unfortunately, was run over by a railway train. Weighed 6.5 tons.
Run under or run through?
No, the the railway train was just as badly damaged as poor Jumbo.
Had to shoot the railway train.
We now have a round of flower names and how they came to be christened. 2 marks, if you can tell me how the following got their names. Anne Scott James, Dahlia, though in the United States I think they call it Dahlia, as in the film The Blue Dahlia.
Well, my derivation is that this flower was a sort of F1 hybrid discovered by a man called Arne Dahl, D-A-H-L.
Yes, this is a native of Mexico in Central America, and there was a Swedish botanist, Professor Dahl. He discovered it there in, I think, just before 1791 when he died. It was introduced into Europe in 1789, and into Britain, I think, by the Marchioness of Bute, or so I'm told. That's the Dahlia or Dahlia. 2 marks. Thank you. Dandelion.
This is culled by a chap called Burdock. Walking through, he took it home and dandelion.
Yes.
It's because the finch. See, yes. The finch.
Don
de
Leon.
No.
Yes.
Don
de
Leon.
Yes,
that's
it.
Don de
Leon. You're getting there. Don de Leon, but because the
petals looks like it.
Look like the teeth of Finch lion. Certainly not like African lions.
You're there. It's 2 marks. Don de Leon means lion's tooth. And I don't know whether it's the tooth petals or those very serrated leaves that a dandelion has, which again are toothed. Anyway, one or the other. Was thought to resemble lion's teeth. And dandelion is simply an anglicizing of this French word. We're not very good at French. 2 marks. Tillis Powell. Gladiolus. I think there are some people who call it gladiolus, but I prefer gladiolus.
Gladiolus. It's because it looks like a little sword.
Yes.
Its leaves look like a sword.
Yes, that's all right. It's found first in Pliny, who was a Roman botanist.
You were near.
Yes.
And he applied it to a plant he called the sword lily, but now it's, I'm told, an iridaceous plant with sword-shaped leaves and bright flower spikes. And it's thought that the Romans thought, in turn, that the spikes resembled the bright swords of the gladiators as they marched into the arena and waved them around in the air. Gladiators. Dennis Norton, cowslip.
If you walk across a field in which there are cows, particularly if you're wearing new suede shoes, there's a certain hazard in which everybody slips except a cow. It should be called a man slip, actually. It was corrupted into cow slip.
You're absolutely right.
Well, you need a sound. I'm not absolutely. Excessively surprised.
You get your 2 marks at once. Cowslip, a very pretty little flower, has by origin an extremely unpretty name because slip, spelt in Old English SLYPPE, is the old word for dung, including cow dung.
All over the country tomorrow, little children will be chalking up SLYPPE. It's an old English word.
This flower does flourish on pasture land, as Dennis is quite right to say. Luckily, it also flourishes if you want to keep your suede shoes clean on railway embankments and cuttings, so you might be safer there. We come now to the last round and go back to those quotations I gave the two teams earlier in the programme. 2 marks, and Scott James, can you give me the origin of the quotation, "What are the wild waves saying?"
I should think it's in the Oxford Book of English Verse.
Yes.
Around the Victorian period.
1 out of 2, for knowing it's a Victorian poet. But it's by a chap called Joseph Edwards Carpenter, who was born in 1813, and therefore does qualify as a Victorian poet. Just how the origin of your quotation, is your journey really necessary?
It was a notice which was posted up on railway stations during the war.
Why?
So that you shouldn't travel unnecessarily and clutter up the trains.
Absolutely right. This is a famous wartime poster, for those who are too young to remember the last war, to cut down civilian travel at a time when the railways were being used for a great deal of troop travel as well, and possibly on road travel, so as to avoid using up too much petrol. Well, now I'm going to ask Dennis and Frank to give me their explanations of how these quotations came to being. And in this round, the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. So back to Dennis Norden and his quotation. What are the wild waves saying?
Well, I can't tell you how relieved I was to hear that quotation on this programme, because what it means, the very fact that it's in the programme, it means that a very good friend of all of us here is now well on his way to recovering his, let's not put too fine a point upon it, sanity. And I refer to the man who for many, many years now has set the, made up the questions, not only for My Word, but for its sister ship, a program called My Music. And this man is called
Edward J. Mason. Very recently, he said to me, I've had it. I said, well, congratulations, because we're both. He said, this question devising, he said, it's getting on top of me at last. I said, oh, come on. I said, it can't be all that difficult. He said, it is the way I do it. And then he made an astonishing confession. You see, what he does is he does this whole question devising business back to front. I mean by that, he sort of stands facing away from the typewriter. I mean, what he does, he writes an answer down first. And then he looks around for a question to fit it. Now, look, for example, 1 week, he hit on a marvellous answer, no W. And it's got to be literary as well, because it's a literary programme, you know. 8 weeks, he was on that, and finally he came up with the question, why couldn't Wordsworth sell his country cottage? No, doubly. And he was so pleased with it that when we went from there into a series of my music, he then wanted to put down no W as an answer to a musical question. And he really strained himself on this one. And finally came up with what did Wagner used to say when people asked him if he spelled his name with a V? You see, he was in no W. But it was because of my music that the really serious crack-up started. Because Ted got it into his head 1 week that a very good answer would be, it's a bit of sandy shore. And he wanted to find a question to fit. Now, I would have thought that was a bit of a piece of cake. Because all you do is you play a snatch of a Sandy Shaw record and say, then ask the question, is what was that? It's a bit of Sandy Shaw. But Ted said, no, that's too obvious. Because he sets himself very high standards for this. We went through the whole series of my music and he couldn't find a question to fit. It's a bit of Sandy Shaw. Well, I knew it was, he rang me up 3 o'clock in the morning one day. He said, what colour was Bernard Shaw's beard? Was it at all yellowish? So I said, because I had this idea of passing a bit of hair round among the My Word panel, and, you know, and I said, it was red. And he sort of sighed. And then we heard that they'd taken him away 2 weeks ago, and they put him in, you know, one of those places. And we thought we'd seen the last of him until we got this telegram, have solved it, we'll use it as question in My Word. And so you can imagine the relief tonight when I found that for the answer, it's a bit of sandy shore, he found the question, what are the wild waves saying?
Such a libelous account of Edward J. Mason. If this were telly, I'd bring him on to dance a can-can in front of you. Well, we go on from that to the other quotation and another story, to Frank Muir, and Is Your Journey Really Necessary?
I was very thoughtful this morning when I opened my letters and read them. I'm usually such a happy little chap at breakfast. And oddly enough, it wasn't a letter from some old codger named Tate, which made me cogitate. It was a letter from a Mrs. Sarah Leatherbarrow from Griffith, New South Wales, Australia. And it was a, you know, she listened to the show out in Australia, and she said some things about me, you know, supercilious twit, I said, you know, fan mail stuff I won't bore you with. And At the end of the letter, she said, P.S. My husband, Johnny, is much nicer than you are. Now, I'm willing... She knew her husband, but the unfairness of it was that she didn't really know me, just because I had a voice like a supercilious twit. She didn't know the positive factors. It's terribly unfair to judge me against her husband when she didn't know anything about me, you know, and if I told her some of my qualities, she could then really judge me against her husband. And, of course, you know, it's very difficult to, in 6 minutes, to list these things. And it seemed to me if I just sort of narrowed it down a bit to those little imperfections, as the poet says, which are a person's charm. I was trying to think what sort of imperfections I have. Very difficult, you know, because if I have a fault, which I haven't, it's modesty. It seemed to me that, because I'm 6'7" tall, rather Grecian face, I would say, rather sort of noble, slightly marred by a roguish tendency to smile. Really a sort of combination, I suppose, between Lord Byron and Nellie Wallace. I have some rather tiny holes on my forehead, which have healed up, but some rather fresher ones on my Adam's apple, which still bleeds slightly. But the reason for these is that my wristwatch broke and I sent it in for repair and it took a month. And of course, when your arm has been used to the weight of a wristwatch, it compensates for the weight, you see. And when I first sent it, I found that taking a forkful of spuds and shoving them in my mouth, I forked my forehead. But I overcame that after I had these rather group of holes in my forehead by sellotaping fivepence on my wrist, which compensated. But apparently the watch is broken, and I had to buy a new one, which is rather heavier. So my Adam's apple at the moment. But I'm going to cut half a bed spring and tape it under my left arm. I think that'll be all right. My left nostril is slightly wider than my right. The reason for this is that my teeth don't meet in the front. I clench my teeth, the back ones meet, but there's still a gap in the front one. So when I eat corn on the cob, I have to turn the cob facing north and south, sort of vertically, and using the left-hand front tooth as a chisel, I have to poke the cob upwards. And sometimes, I poke a bit too hard and it stuffs up my nose. And really the only other delightful little peccadillo I have is that I really do have... I'm a virtuoso snorer. Now, like most chaps, I didn't believe I snored at all, but my wife recorded me about 2 months ago. A full half-hour tape. It's most fantastic sound. There were deep booms, and you could hear jet engines revving up in the back. But, it pays Mrs. Leatherborough, this is the point, because we've lent the tape to the BBC, and they use part of it for the sound of a dinosaur with its foot caught. So, really, be fair, Mrs. Leatherborough. I mean, there are a list of my qualities. Weigh those up in your mind, Mrs. Leatherborough, my dear sailor, and ask yourself again the question, is your Johnny really nicer, Sarah?
Well, by your vote, ladies and gentlemen, Frank Muir wins the contest of the two stories, and he and his partner, Dillis Powell, win the entire My Word contest by 2.5 marks from Dennis Norden and Anne Scott James. And that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The The programme was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC. Been listening to My Word from the BBC, heard each week at this time. This is the WFMT Fine Arts Network.